You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 61 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Remember, you can always connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or swing by our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all, thanks so much for tuning in. Today, I've got a super interesting initiative to tell you about. It is called DROG, D-R-O-G. And what the initiative does is create games and workshops in order to teach members of the public, but also students, how to be actual disinformation creators and distributors. And the idea is if you learn how to create disinformation, then you'll be more able to recognize it when you come across it. And today I'm going to be interviewing Ruud Oosterwold. And just for the sake of not completely butchering his Dutch name, I'm going to let him go ahead and say it here.
Do you want me to pronounce it the Dutch as I can?
The Dutch as you can.
Ruud Oosterwold.
Okay, I'll probably end up putting that into the episode. All right, so Ruud and his team have, as I said, they've built this amazing game. You can play it by going to getbadnews.com. And in short, the idea is that you have to become a disinformation informant by growing your followers, by producing polarizing content or attacking fact checkers. And it's one of these games that you just kind of click which option you'd like to do. But the examples of what type of posts and fake news publishing you can do are simply hilarious. So I encourage you to check it out. And there's even a survey accompanying it that has been analyzed by researchers at the University of Cambridge and shows that these inoculation techniques actually work. But the Get Bad News game isn't actually what I think is the most important and interesting part of Ruud's DROG initiative. It's actually workshops that they conduct with students in order to increase literacy around disinformation. And so what they do is they have students think of a disinformation story, pull a picture off of Google Images to accompany that, and then they will actually share this disinformation on their Facebook and Twitter accounts. And when someone clicks it, they get a notification saying, "This is disinformation. Click here to learn more about how to stop disinformation." And then they also are asked to then share that across their networks. And so it has this kind of snowball effect. We should note that this content is deleted after 24 hours. But as we'll discuss in the episode, some of these disinformation stories created by 15-year-olds can reach up to almost a million people. So we're going to dive into that and a couple of other really interesting initiatives that DROG is doing. For example, they have created the first Dutch troll army by having a one-day event bringing in experts to create the perfect disinformation campaign around the 2019 European Parliament election. So if you're interested in that, stay tuned. So let me cut to that interview with Ruud. We met at the European Commission's Joint Research Center in Northern Italy at a workshop looking at tools to counter disinformation. And I thought this was just too interesting, too funny, but really a super effective tool to counter disinformation. So I hope you enjoyed the interview. Ruud, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thank you.
So first off, I have tons of questions about the bad news game, which I think is fantastic. But first, I want to set the stage a little bit and talk about the concept of inoculation. So what is inoculation and how does it relate to disinformation online?
Inoculation, you could see it as a sort of vaccination where we actually try to give you a weakened dose of the virus, what we see as fake news, and then let your body actually create mental antibodies. That's a theory sort of behind inoculation theory.
And why do you think that's needed for disinformation, particularly on social media or on online channels?
Well, it comes from our philosophy that disinformation is there to stay. It's going to be around us. We should therefore not try to block it, but somehow embrace it. And with inoculation, we can actually show you how disinformation works so that you can become confident at recognizing it.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is the kind of whole idea behind DROG, if I have the pronunciation more or less right, where you were talking about today a sort of manifesto that you guys put together with four principles. Do you mind going into those and kind of telling us like how Drog formed and the sort of ideas and mission behind it?
So it all started off when I was studying Russian studies at Leiden University in 2014. And I was reading all about the stuff that was happening in Ukraine. And at some point, I totally lost track of what was the truth and what was not concerning the Russian disinformation at that time, just really spoiling the internet. And I found that so interesting that I wanted to write my master's thesis on how that was actually possible, because I wanted to be able to grasp what was going on. And that was the main start-off point for what eventually became Drog, because I wrote my master's thesis on it. And I started working for the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs as a research intern, focusing on Russian disinformation at that time. And I thought at that point that stuff like that wouldn't happen in the Netherlands because we have a really strong media landscape. But when we actually had a referendum on the association agreement with Ukraine, I saw all around me that it was actually possible to distract everybody in the Netherlands as well. And at that point, I realized that journalism and disinformation can be in the same country at the same time, and it's not the one or another. It can be both. And so my theory, what eventually became Drog, was that if it's there, we need to do something else than to fact check, because fact checking is always a little too late. Censorship won't work because people will not accept that. And what is then left? What can you do? As a journalist, there's not much you can do. As a government, there's not much you can do. So my first idea was we should just create so much disinformation and show how easy it is so that people finally understand that it's not about the truth, it's just about manipulation.
And that's such an interesting take on disinformation, because as you said, there's so much fact-checking out there. How can providing more disinformation actually help to solve the problem of disinformation?
Yeah, so let me get the manifesto in that sense, because that's the core principle, is that we shouldn't try to beat it, we should embrace it. That's what we wrote in our manifesto, and it's based on four principles. And the first one is facts are obsolete in the first line of defense against disinformation. I mean, facts won't let you convince others when they're already convinced of something else. The second rule is that the greatest victims of the disinformation cause the greatest problems, because you can, as a hostile actor, you can create disinformation, but it only works if you have like a really big group of people that will actually amplify it. And those people are actually the true believers and at the same time the victims of the disinformation and cause the biggest problem at the same time. And they are extremely hard to reach. And the third rule is that the internet has never been a clean place. We shouldn't want to be able to have the illusion that we need to roam the internet without ever seeing something that's nonsense or fake. And the fourth rule is that we should create our own playing field, because if we are constantly reacting to disinformation, we're always one step behind.
Mm. And I guess the way that the manifesto has so far been enacted out is the bad news game,
yeah,
which is, I think, a really awesome concept. So can you just kind of give us a brief introduction into what the bad news game is? And then I have a host of questions for you about specifics.
The bad news game is a game, it's just online, a browser game, and what you have to do is become the best disinformant there is. So you have to destroy the world, you have to make sure there's an uprising against politicians in your country, and it's based on the idea that you go through six stages, so you can earn six badges. Every badge is a technique that you can learn, and then you get the credits for instance, polarization or impersonation or other awful stuff, and you constantly cross your own ethical borders. So there's feedback in the game and there's humor. So at the same time, while you're crossing your own ethical borders, you also realize what you can achieve when you're actually the bad guy.
Yeah, and there's a lot from there I want to unpack. But the first is those techniques of manipulation that you're actually allowed to do in the game. How did you come up with those?
We came up with those. I mean, it took almost a year before the game was actually finished. So it took a lot of time conceptualizing what we actually wanted to achieve and how we wanted to do that. Of course, we did some research on disinformation already. For instance, my master's thesis and my colleague, Jon Rosenbeek, was also working on disinformation. And we somewhat distilled, like, okay, we want like six chapters. What techniques can we choose to fit in those six chapters? And the fun fact was that when we finally had them, we read a paper published by the NATO Stratcom Center for Excellence in Riga, and they had eight techniques, which were like practically the same as what we had written down. So we were absolutely in a right direction, because we didn't really focus on the content of the message, but more on the manipulation, for instance, on a societal level. So just mentioning all six, we have, first you do impersonation, you start to use emotion to actually create emotion within your audience, hate and fear most of the time. Polarization, you have to split groups left and right, I mean you just have to divide them. There's conspiracy theories, there's a defense, so you have to defend yourself against fact checkers, for instance. And the last one is trolling.
Okay. And there's some really interesting ways that you allow for people to sort of user generate that, which we'll get to in a second. But I still want to break down some of the actual concepts of the gameplay itself. And you mentioned that users will acquire badges as they go along. And I'm guessing that goes with this idea of gamification. Did you conceptualize gamification as an important part of the game when you were creating it?
Well, that it became a game was actually a sort of coincidence. That it just came up in the process, because we just wanted to create a generator at first that would randomly generate texts that were nonsense, add pictures to it, spread it online, use Twitter bots to promote it so that you could just see all those elements in place clicking one button. And we wanted it to have a longer lasting impact. So the game element slipped into it because we were on a really tight schedule. We had to develop something in 2 months, so we decided to make a paper-based game. So that's actually the first step that we did, and we tested that, and they actually already did some research on that at Cambridge University. And from the paper game, we actually tried to make it digital. And the fun fact is, nobody in our team, not even the designers, nobody had ever created a game. So for us, it wasn't really trying to gamify it, but it was like the only way that we could talk about all the elements that are needed to discuss the subject.
Mm-hmm. And one of the key points of the game, I think, because maybe some of the listeners are thinking, you know, how do you get people to, or how is it ethical to get people to make their own disinformation campaign? But I think a key part of the game is the role of humor. So can you go into how humor is kind of injected into the game and why that's important?
Yeah. So for instance, you start mocking a foreign country or something. So you start like, I don't know, my colleague wrote all the nice little jokes inside. But for instance, when there's an attack by a fact checker, I mean, there's a fact checker who's revealing that you're spreading fake news. There's only two options for you to choose. In this particular instance, you only have the option between deny everything or attack personally. So if you go for the personal attack, you can just choose like three different ways to attack a fact checker. For instance, claiming that he's been at a sex party or that he's downloaded too much movies illegally. And there's always a like the best option and a lesser option. So if you say that he's downloaded over 100 illegal movies, it's like, okay, well, what do you want to achieve?
right.
And if you start mentioning the sex party, which is, I mean, you can just say, where was he last Friday? Then you just imply that there might have been a sex party involved. Mm. And it's maybe not the best example, but I should maybe get one. I'll just read one of the first one that I did.
First of all, what is it? What does it say? Do you want to read it or should I?
You can read, yeah.
So one of the examples is, the United States is like marzipan toilet paper, worse than useless, #Britain first.
from John Doe, whose tagline is "Love my abs, all natural."
So, is this included in the game, or is this something that someone, a user, has put in?
No, this is actually this is you trying to actually achieve some emotional effect using social media for the first time. So you just created a fake persona, John Doe, and you have to stir some turmoil. I mean, you have to achieve something. So this is your first tweet. Of course, it doesn't work because you don't have the followers yet.
Oh, so you accumulate followers over the course of the game based on what strategies you choose.
Yeah, so like you either get a lot of followers or you either get a lot of credibility, which is, of course, not credibility in the sense that you're telling the truth, but credibility in the sense of manipulating others to think you're credible.
Mm. And one of the things that you've been doing with this game is actually branching it out into research on disinformation as well, right? And so you have some collaboration going on with the University of Cambridge. Can you describe kind of what you're looking at there in terms of that academic industry partnership?
Well, it's really important. I mean, for us as a company, doing things together with the university was a really important part of actually being able to show that we might be onto something. So my co-founder actually went to do his PhD at Cambridge University and met up with Sander van der Linden there, who is actually a social psychologist. He runs the social decision-making lab in Cambridge, and he was focusing on inoculation theory. And our game turned out to be a perfect tool for him to do research on. So what we've done is build in a survey into the game that we, when we launched it, we had those 100,000 people play it in the first week already. So we've had tens of thousands filled in surveys, of which I think they can use about 20,000 to do research on.
Hmm.
So they did a pre-post testing to check if those techniques that we actually use as the badges in the game, if they become better at recognizing those techniques after playing our game. And we've seen significant increase in their abilities.
So the inoculation techniques are sort of scientifically validated.
Yes.
Huh. And as far as I understand, the game was extremely popular when it actually was released, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we had the help of the Cambridge University who pushed it to certain media. We were mentioned in 380 news outlets in 1 week.
Hmm.
And we had 100,000 people play the game in the first week.
Interesting. And I'm curious as to how, on the sort of back end, how did you make the decisions in designing the game and then beta testing it? Because obviously, I mean, this is not something that just came out on the first try, right?
No. It was quite difficult because we wanted to create something that people can stumble upon on the internet and then click three times and then really get sucked into it. And it was really difficult to actually have like as much information as possible in the beginning, but not overflood everyone with boring information. So it was a quest actually to find a way to make it funny, informational, and really attract people to actually play further.
Mm-hmm.
But we've tested that on a lot of people in our just who are around.
I want to talk about what I think is the sort of most interesting part of all of this, which is the sort of simulated troll farms that you've been building. can you sort of go into that process and sort of what the results of that have been so far?
Yeah. Well, what we've done is we started off with a game, but then because we got some attention, people asked us to do other things as well, and we ended up somehow having school children create fake news, publish it on one of our fake news websites, and then actually spreading it throughout their whole network, and all in order to accumulate as much unique visitors as possible for them to show how easy it is to produce fake news and to gather people. And it works as a vaccine, actually, because everybody who clicks on it gets a pop-up that states, "This is completely bogus, made by 2 15-year-olds. Here you can learn more about the problem. And please, before you tell everybody, share it in your own network."
Mm. And so actually, some of the fake news or disinformation that was sort of generated by these students actually had quite a big reach in the Netherlands. Can you recount that example? I thought that was just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. So normally, like a school class of about 20 children gathers about 1,000 to 5,000 unique visitors to the website in 24 hours. And after 24 hours, everything is deleted.
And that's by breaking them up into groups and saying...
Yes, they work in groups of two, and they just create one article per two, and they try to gather as much as possible. And most of the times, it's like four articles that gather the most traffic. But we have one example where we actually we let that one continue after 24 hours because it was just too perfect. It was about a heat wave in the Netherlands, but it was published in May because we did have a heat wave, but there were no signs of that at that time. And somehow they published that in certain networks where people would really love a heat wave. And we reached in 1 week 800,000 people, but we didn't just reach them. They actually clicked on it. So they were unique visitors to our website.
Mm.
And 800,000 visitors is the same as 5% of the Dutch population.
It's crazy. So like in this case, for example, the students had created the text of the article, added a photo to the article, and then actually used their own Facebook and Twitter accounts to promote it.
Yeah.
And then when it's clicked on, people are given a message saying, hi, this is fake news.
Yes.
And then there's another step. I forget which one it was.
It's announced that it's fake news and that they should spread it also within their own networks. But after 24 hours, everything is deleted. That's actually the whole process.
Mm. And as you were saying, that sort of acts as the vaccination, right?
Yeah.
Like, hi, you've fallen for clicking this, this news.
We do the workshops in the schools. It's just 1.5 hour where we let them create their own fake news and publish it. And there's the complete day of creating a disinformation troll factory where you have to come up with a campaign and destroy something.
Right. And that is called, I have it written down somewhere, the annual Supreme League of Masters for Disinformation or something
like that. Yeah, that's what we called it. Yeah. We even flew in a former employee of the Russian Internet Research Agency, the Troll Factory in St. Petersburg, to help us build the first Dutch troll army. Yeah.
Mm. And how did that go? What was the sort of context of that event?
So we wanted actually to find out firsthand how you should build a troll factory and what you can do with it. So therefore we flew her in. I mean, this is Lyudmila Savchuk. She's not just a former employee. She's actually a research journalist who already was a journalist before she went to work there. So she went undercover.
Hmm.
But instead of just talking about how troll factories work, we thought we could better just create one ourselves so we can completely understand how it would work. And then come up with a campaign that would, well, we had a theme that we would destroy the European parliamentary elections of 2019 so that we actually could come up with the worst case scenario so they could do prevention based on that.
Mm-hmm. And so that's obviously a very timely topic. And we have a lot of listeners who are interested in European politics. So I want to ask first, why did you choose the 2019 EP elections as the ground for creating disinformation around?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we struggled with that for a long time because we didn't really know what we were supposed to do on such a day. And then we thought, well, we need a victim. We need a target. And because you don't really want to hurt anyone. And somehow this eventually, after weeks of thinking about possible targets, this just came into our heads. And it was the perfect solution, actually, because we wouldn't hurt anyone. We had a lot of contacts already within the EU, so we had some lines that we could tell people, like, we're going to do this, and are you interested in joining us as well? And it somehow all fell into place when we decided to do that. And it's funny, because if you look in hindsight, it might be just a weird idea, but it was actually, we couldn't have come up with a better subject, I think.
So we're... European Union officials excited about the idea? They kind of approved it?
Well, we actually have one person from the European Parliament present, but not just her, also people from the big cybersecurity firms, the Minister of Interior. So it was like a crowd of people who are already dealing with the subject and some sort of white hackers style people who are just really interested in not really finding a concrete solution, but actually building up to a solution by doing the stuff that the bad guys do.
Mm. And what were the main kind of strategies that came out of that? Or what exactly were you guys, what were you doing and what was the outcome of that?
We had several different We divided them up into like different departments. So we had a tech department, a governance department, a cloning and doctoring target department, an analytics department. So everybody was doing what they knew best and trying to build it together to accomplish this campaign. Eventually, I mean, I was under the impression that we could completely come up with like bot structures and that people already would have mockups, etc. One day was a little bit too short for that. But what we did get out of it was like a complete list of possible targets and topics that we could target them with. And we had structures where we could actually use different techniques to actually constantly iterate our fake news to become better and better and better. So there were like every department came up with a plan how we could work together as a whole, and it's still something that we need to combine all to come up with like the grand strategy that we've created at that day. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting to see how people would come up with, for instance, the main hashtag that they came up with, which would be like the basis of their campaign, was a hashtag honest work. So if we would claim the hashtag honest, everybody else would, of course, be dishonest. And if we, as a troll factory, would be the only honest people in the world, we could own that.
Right, which is kind of, as you were saying earlier, playing to those emotions a little bit, right, to polarize the electorate.
Yeah.
So basically, everyone was working in their different parts of the troll factory, and then it one day was too short to combine it all together. Yeah. Okay, well, the IRA wasn't built in a day, I suppose. What are the future steps for the game and for Drog? You have, I think, built a really great, successful product using these inoculation techniques, and it's picked up a lot of interest, right, around Europe and abroad. So can you go into kind of where the product is going now and kind of maybe what's ahead in the future for the company?
So it's actually, there's like three pillars on which we work, which is education, but also the business enterprises. We train their personnel, and then there's the campaigns that we do. So the game, for instance, we saw as a campaign, but it actually turned out that people really see a need for that also within companies. So for instance, the armed forces, they ordered a special edition to train their officers. We are now creating a special adaptation for the game for civil servants in the Netherlands. And we want to evolve that as well into other areas, because it's a really easy way to train a couple of thousand people at once and make them aware of it. And we're translating it to 12 different languages. And we make a special version for 8 to 10 year olds. And which will be really interesting to polarize between, I don't know, teddy bears and Barbies. I don't know.
Interesting, because some of the examples, especially when, you know, students are creating their own, I guess, can be a bit inappropriate maybe for 8 to 10 year olds. Yeah. How are you going to plan to do that with simply teddy bears and things like that?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, I think that we can still use the same techniques, but you have to use other examples. So, I mean, a difference between left and right in politics is far too abstract for children.
Mm.
But they do see those things happening as well. I mean, for us, it's an interesting experiment to develop something like that. But one of our colleagues already is pushing us to look at the youth television, Jeugdjournaal in the Netherlands.
Mm.
It's practically, you can leave it practically the same, but you just have to use examples that are common to them. And for the workshops, we're going to distribute as a theory of change throughout all of Europe. We got a grant to accomplish that within the next 2 years. And we do really want to, like what we first call it a hackathon, the thing where we create the disinformation campaigns.
The annual Supreme League of Masters of Disinformation.
We're going to... We would really like to repeat the annual league, and not even annually, but we can make it a monthly league. And actually, not just to get insights on and to do prevention on, but also to train people in becoming confident about what is disinformation and when should I report something and what can I actually do to help it eventually.
Mm. Do you track at all the social media metrics of how many people clicked on Twitter or Facebook from within your 24-hour window?
Yeah, absolutely. That's we want to do it even better because now we just have the unique visitors. And that's, I mean, it's nice to see, but it would be even more nice to see how things would spread within the networks, the social networks. But we don't really have the access to it. I know some people who have made tools that might make it visible, but we're still looking into that.
Super interesting. Well, Ruud, I think it is a fascinating initiative. And thanks so much for taking the time out. This has been great.
Thank you. Been a lovely time. And I think we should go for beers on the Lago Maggiore now.
And I think we will, as we have a dinner to attend. So once again, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
I've just been speaking with Ruud Oosterwold, co-founder of Drog. Make sure you check out the Get Bad News game at getbadnews.com. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you again for tuning in. Next week, we're getting in full U.S. midterms mode by talking to Nazim Makia. He is the CEO of Outvote, which is an app that allows anyone in the U.S. to find who they know in a swing district and remind them to vote. Until then, I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.